Case number 07-1300 et al. J.J. Kassan & Bakery, Incorporated, Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Silverman for the petitioner, Ms. Haney for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Silverman. I represent the petitioner, J.J. Kassan Bakery. We ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal in connection with this argument. Petitioner requests that this court set aside the supplemental decision and order of the National Labor Relations Board and deny the NLRB's cross motion to enforce that decision. We believe that the NLRB's supplemental decision and order should be set aside for the following reasons. When the NLRB affirmed Judge ALJ Davis's decision, order, and findings, except in one respect, and adopted his recommended order, we submit that the NLRB violated Section 554D of the Administrative Procedure Act, as well as constitutional protections provided for due process and administrative hearings. Section 554D of the Administrative Procedure Act provides that the employee who presides at the reception of the evidence shall make a recommended decision or initial decision required by 557 of this title unless he becomes unavailable. That didn't happen in this case. What happened in this case is the initial judge who heard this case, Judge Edelman, issued a decision. He heard the evidence. He heard the witnesses. He saw the demeanor of the evidence and issued a decision which the NLRB set aside. The NLRB set that decision aside for several reasons. It had several problems with the decision. The first one being that Judge Edelman copied the majority.
Is there a difference between an initial decision and a recommended decision?
I don't believe so.
The statute just using two phrases for the same thing?
Under the NLRB, it's the recommended decision because the board can accept or reject that decision. And I've never heard it referred to as an initial decision. Only in board parlance have I heard recommended decision. In any event, the NLRB's...
Let me follow up on that a little bit. I'm looking at 5 U.S. Code Section 557, which does seem to make some distinction between them. Talks about an initial decision and suggests that that's the decision that if no appeal is taken from it, becomes the decision of the agency, but doesn't use that same sort of description for a recommended decision. I don't know.
I think that's a distinction without a difference, Your Honor. I think that the recommended decision is the initial decision here, in fact, in the NLRB case. And that became the decision of the NLRB.
So the statute that talks about initial decision or recommended decision, that's just being redundant?
Well, I'm not sure.
We typically don't look at statutes that way.
What the distinction is. And it may be that in other administrative proceedings it's referred to as an initial decision. But I don't know, Your Honor. Okay. But the problem that the board had with the initial decision or the recommended decision, Your Honor, was twofold. Number one was the extent of the copying. Now, we don't dispute the fact that copying in and of itself under Waterbury is not grounds for setting aside a decision. But here the board found something more. It was not just the fact of copying. It was the fact that the majority of the decision was copied, as the board indicated in its initial in its decision, number one. And number two, that the copying was not only just the facts section of the briefs of the general counsel of the NLRB and the union, but it was the legal analysis. And therefore, from those two facts, the board concluded, A, that Judge Edelman gave the impression of bias against my client, and number two, gave the impression that he did not do a thorough analysis of the record, either on the facts or the law. And that's the ill. When the NLRB...
And they fixed the ill, right? They did a review of the record themselves and found that there was no base, there was in fact no bias, and then they had another ALJ take a look at it and concluded there was no bias.
No, Your Honor, we submit that they didn't fix the ill. What happened was, they remanded the case with instructions to a second administrative law judge to review the record and, if he so choose, to make demeanor resolutions based upon the record that was established by the first administrative law judge, whom the board had already said gave the impression of bias and gave the impression of not having done a thorough investigation and review of the record. Now, what's the practical import? The practical import is that we're prejudiced by this. We were prejudiced because when the first judge, I'll use the term cribbed, plagiarized, copied, the facts and the legal analysis, implicit in the facts and the legal analysis, when he cribbed it from the general counsel's brief and the union's brief, and the board makes it clear that it's both, and the majority of decision was cribbed, inherent in every statement of fact in that brief and the legal analysis in that brief are credibility resolutions. Not just demeanor resolutions, but credibility resolutions.
I understand how this differs from our cases that say that copying isn't sufficient to violate due process or fairness.
Well, the difference is more. The problem here is
what,
the administrative.
More copying here than there, or what?
Well, the board made it very clear that this was not just a case of copying because it was aware of Waterbury, yeah. But it said it was more than copying.
I don't understand. In Berger, we said even if the findings are taken verbatim, even if the trial judge adopts proposed findings verbatim, that's not enough. And in the first case that interprets Waterbury in our court, which is the Sino Ready Mix, we say even where its substantial portions are copied, that's not enough.
Well,
I don't understand how much more you can get than substantial and verbatim.
The difference in this case is the board recognized that it was sufficient to wind up setting that decision aside.
Right, but not sufficient for it to believe that the judge was prejudiced, only that there was an appearance of prejudice.
That's correct, appearance of prejudice. But then it sent it to a second administrative law judge, and this is what distinguishes a number of the cases, sent it to a second administrative law judge with an instruction that even though there's an impression of bias, even though there's an impression that there was no thorough in review and analysis of the record, you may adopt the credibility resolutions, the demeanor resolutions of the first ALJ.
Imagine if we thought, what if we were of the view that if the board had simply approved the first judge's decision, that would not violate any rights?
Well,
that creates more of a problem by sending it back?
Well, that's not what they did, and there was a case. That's not what the board did, there was another case, Your Honor.
If we were of the view that the original ALJ's decision, notwithstanding extensive copying, could have been relied upon by the board, that there was no due process or other violation in doing that.
The problem is that
how does sending it back make it worse?
Because it then butts up against 554D.
So you're really resting totally on the APA here.
Well, constitutional due process requirements as well as the APA. But the APA is very clear and express in what it says.
There isn't a constitutional requirement that things be considered orally rather than written in an agency. There are statutory requirements, but there's no constitutional requirement. Is there?
Well, I think there's a due process requirement in administrative proceedings, even aside from
there's
the APA's
process,
requirements.
Is there a due process requirement that requires oral testimony rather than written? Can you tell me any case that, with respect to an administrative agency, obviously not a criminal?
No, I can't, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I can't.
And didn't the board, I think, at least what I heard you say, I don't think it accurately reflected the board's view of what ALJ Edelman had done. I'm looking at the board decision at A11. It says, we will not order a hearing de novo because our review of the record satisfies us that Judge Edelman conducted the hearing itself properly.
Yes.
So they looked at this and they concluded that there may be an appearance of bias, but there was actually no bias.
Well, that's correct, but they said they were talking about the hearing, not his decision. And we submit that the decision, when the board adopted it, with all the faults that were contained in Judge Edelman's decision, when Judge Davis's decision was adopted, that's where the problem lies. That's where the issue is.
Let me ask you about the APA. When was the first time that you cited the APA to the board?
The first time we cited the APA in our exceptions to the ALJ's decision to the board,
ALJ.
We did not cite the APA precisely. However, as this court has said in Blake Construction, you don't have to invoke the magic words. All you have to do is give the board, in this case the board, the agency, the facts on which it is apprised that there is a due process issue, that there is an APA issue.
And when was the first time you did that?
In our exceptions to the board, the second. That's correct.
Two questions.
Well, yes.
The only case you really have about this is these 1954 cases, the Skogmo case, et cetera, right?
Gamble Skogmo, the Pigrenet case, and there's an Arizona case, I believe,
right,
that we cited
so
as
is
well.
Is it enough? I mean, this is a pretty unusual and rarely used section of the APA. Is it enough to simply say we had a right to de novo hearing, which the board could well have taken to mean your due process argument? I certainly agree with that, since it's quite clear what your due process argument is, but not to have understood that you were making an APA argument.
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think that's the case, because not only did we refer to the improper action of relying on the demeanor resolutions in 1, 2, 3 of our exceptions, which are in the record on appeal, but also when you take a look at our argument, our brief to the board, which is contained in the supplemental appendix at A231, going forward, 2 pages, we made it clear that we were relying on cases which invoked Section 554D of the APA.
There's no citation to that section, is there?
Of the APA?
Yeah.
No, there isn't.
And those cases like Gamble Skogmo, didn't rely only on the APA. It also looked at the due process question, right?
It did.
Yeah.
It did. But it clearly referred to the APA, as did Pigrenet, I believe.
Let me ask one last question. You didn't raise this issue at all, either by citing the APA or by citing the Skogmo case, after the board sent it to the second ALJ and before the second ALJ conducted his review, right?
That is correct.
So, in fact, the ALJ says no party requested that I reopen the hearing or recall any witnesses. I offered the parties an opportunity to file a brief with me concerning the board's order, but none did. So what do you say to the argument that you were waiting to see whether the second one came out in a way that was beneficial to you? If it did, you wouldn't raise the APA argument. And if it didn't, you had the APA in your back pocket.
Not at all, Your Honor. The reason why we didn't raise it was because this case was sent back to the second administrative law judge with directions that there would be no de novo hearing. It was our position that the only way to remedy the wrong was for a de novo hearing.
You never told the board that either the Skogmo case or the APA required a de novo hearing. So they never had the opportunity to say, my God, you're right. We're not going to do this. We're not going to waste another ALJ's complete time on this.
Your Honor, in our brief to the board, we specifically said.
This is a brief to the board after the second ALJ.
That's correct.
Right. So what I'm asking is, did the timely way to have raised this argument would have been before the second ALJ conducted whatever he did, which was look at the transcripts and everything else and offer opportunity, not to wait until after. Why didn't you raise this before?
With all due respect, it was not a final order of the board, number one.
Well, you couldn't raise it with us. I understand that, but you could have raised it with the board.
No, but we couldn't have. If we raised it first to the administrative law judge, the administrative law judge was bound by what the board told it to do, and it said no de novo review. You may take additional testimony. You may take further testimony. From our perspective, Your Honor.
Would you have asked the NLRB to have reconsidered based on the APA at that point?
I don't think that there was a specific way to do that, Your Honor.
Why? Well, they issued an order.
Yes.
Don't they have a provision for request for reconsideration of orders?
I don't know of a specific provision, Your Honor, for them to do that. But the point is that the second ALJ could not have disobeyed the board.
Well, the second ALJ could have said that, you know, you didn't. The board didn't consider that there's an APA problem here because nobody raised it, and we need to send that, you know, I need to stop here and have that, if you want to make that argument, make it to the board.
Well,
I mean, it seems like a terrible waste here. We've gone through now two hearings. The only result, if you win here, is yet a third hearing. Had he made the argument earlier, we could have cut it short earlier.
Well, except for the fact that the board, this was not the first case that came before the board. The board was aware of the problem with Judge Edelman. In the first case, the Fairfield condominium case, it slapped him on the wrist and then went ahead and adopted his decision for various reasons, including the fact that he claimed that the board said that there was a complete review of the record. The second case, Dish Network, which is the basis on which this was sent back, the board made it clear that they were not going to accept a decision that relied upon Judge Edelman's absolute copying of the briefs. Now, you know,
maybe they would have had they known that there would have to be a de novo hearing. So what if we were, under the APA, if they reinstated Edelman's decision and made their decision on that ground, you would have no APA argument.
Well, right? I don't think that Judge Edelman's decision can be instated. It was set aside, and there's nothing before the court
What if we hold now that there was, that you were wrong, that is, with your due process attacks on that decision, that in fact there is no due process violation there in light of Waterbury and the other cases, and that the NLRB could, if it wished, simply reinstate that? I mean,
I think that would
eliminate at least the 554 argument.
That would require a reversal of the board order itself, and there was no appeal from the board order.
We wouldn't reverse. We would say it's up to them. They can decide. Yes, 554D bars reliance on the second ALJ, but it doesn't bar reliance on the first ALJ. So the board can do whatever it wants at this point. It could have a third ALJ, or it could simply reinstate the first.
What would
stop them from reinstating the first?
Well, I don't think that the board can go back now and reinstate a decision that it's already set aside where there's a second ALJ decision. It didn't adopt Edelman's decision. It adopted the second ALJ's decision.
Well,
it set aside, vacated, as if it never were.
And it's not required. It's never required to adopt the ALJ, the first or the second, the board.
That's correct. But having gone through the procedure and having appointed a second ALJ and having put us through the trial having the second ALJ review the record, I don't think you can go back now. I think there would be inherent problems in the board's procedure if the court were now to say, go ahead back and reinstate the first decision.
Okay. Who presided at the initial decision?
The initial decision was Judge Edelman. And Judge Edelman had 10 decisions where the board found that he repeatedly and consistently cribbed the briefs of the GC and the union and found for the GC in every case. Clearly, there was something wrong that the board smelled in the way this was being handled. And we submit that
why haven't you just given away your 554D argument? If Judge Edelman presided at the initial decision, he's the one that took evidence.
Because it was set aside, and that's not the decision that the board adopted. The board adopted Judge Davis's decision.
This wasn't the initial decision. So you're saying Judge Davis's was the initial decision?
I'm sorry.
Is that what you're saying?
First in time was Judge Edelman's, yes. First in terms of the statute, in terms of initial or recommended decision.
Well, see, now you get back to my original question. What's the initial decision mean? What's the recommended decision mean? Maybe we can ask NLRB to give us.
Well, here it's a question of what the set aside mean, actually. Isn't that right?
Well,
if the first ALJ's decision was set aside, is it vacated and doesn't exist?
We submit that it's as if it never were, and that's another ill because when the board said to Judge Davis, you can adopt demeanor resolutions of a decision that's been set aside, in our mind vacated, and as if it never were, it then compounded the problem.
Well, or it qualified the degree to which it was setting aside, with that limitation, in other words.
Well, that issue wasn't briefed, Your Honor. It was never raised by the board. The only problem the board had with the issue under the APA, they say we waived it, and of course we say in our briefs it was clear we raised it. We raised the facts and the cases under the APA to apprise the board there was an APA argument, and then they said that the problem was obviated because Judge Davis, quote, reflected the opinions or the demeanor resolutions of Judge Edelman, and we submit that's not what 554 had in mind, 554D had in mind when it was enacted.
Say after hearing from you and from your opponent, We completely agree with you on every count. And we think you're the best writer we've ever seen, and we can't improve on your writing. Would it be, what would it violate were we to write an opinion that simply copies your brief? Under those circumstances, where we think you're completely right on each issue, and you're the most eloquent person we've ever had with respect to writing, and we think we can't improve on it. Would that violate something?
Well, the board found that...
What do you think? Would it, if we were to adopt your arguments and your words, after due consideration...
I think under the circumstances, if I had written 10 other decisions and I found for one side in 10 other decisions, and I know we can't be a bean counter here and add and total and things like that, but after the NLRB says it gave the impression...
The number of times we agree with you would be the problem?
No. That's simply a factor, Your Honor. No, it's more than that. It's the fact that there was no thorough independent review of the record. It appeared to the board who oversees the ALJs and who reviews...
Not what they said. I thought they said that they thought there was nothing wrong with it other than the appearance question, but... I thought they said they didn't...
Appearance of bias and an appearance that there was no thorough independent investigation, thorough and independent analysis of the legal facts and legal argument. I believe those are...
We remand this reluctantly because the transcript satisfies us that Judge Adelman conducted the hearing impartially in an appropriate judicial manner, and we do not suggest that the judge's findings were in error.
But if you go to A11... it says the impression given is that Judge Adelman failed to conduct an independent analysis of the case's underlying facts and legal issues.
It's the impression problem.
The impression,
not the fact.
That's correct. It's the impression. Yeah, but the impression of bias.
The fact is that they thought he'd done fine. This was just dealing with impressions.
In the conduct of the hearing.
You're being extra cautious.
In the conduct of the hearing, which is separate and apart from the writing of the decision and the thought process, the mental thought process, the deliberative process that went into it. And when I say...
I think if the board had thought that the decision itself was somehow flawed in that, they might have said more directly here. They haven't said that.
They might have. They didn't. But what they did do is set it aside, and they set it aside for a reason. They may not have fully articulated... that this sentence that I just read is the reason why they set it aside. I think it's fair to assume that when one finds an impression of bias and when one finds an impression that the judge has not given a thorough analysis of the legal facts, that's sufficient reason to set it aside. I think it follows that from the board's decision that's the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Silverman.
I'm going to have to say good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Heaney, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board, which is here today seeking to enforce its order, finding that the bakery here committed numerous unfair labor practices during the union's most recent organization campaign.
Can you help me understand if there's a difference between an initial decision and a recommended decision, why the statute uses both those phrases?
Of course, I was hoping you'd ask me that question. I'm going to give it my best shot and tell you that the board adopts recommended decisions from the ALJ. We've always, if you look in, just even in the orders that you see here before you from both decisions, they say they're reviewing the recommended decision. They're reviewing the recommended order. As to what is an initial decision, I'm afraid I cannot speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree that ALJ Edelman's decision is not in play? That's not an initial decision. That's not a recommended decision here because it's been vacated. And the initial decision, the recommended decision here, is that by Judge Davis?
Judge Davis is the decision that the board reviewed.
And that's the recommended decision?
That's the recommended decision.
Can you tell me whether the company had the opportunity to seek rehearing or reconsideration of the board's initial order to not have a de novo hearing?
I think they had two options available to them. One would be what you had pinpointed, was that they could have, at the invitation of Judge Davis, filed a motion regarding the board's first order, talking about, and there they could have raised the APA arguments and, of course, addressed any issues where they thought the demeanor-based determinations would had played an outcome in the first judge's decision. They also could have...
Excuse me, before you go on, you said they could have done that after the remand to the second judge?
Correct. I don't think they could not have filed a motion for reconsideration, so I don't think my answer was exact. But they could have, when Judge Davis, the second judge, asked the parties or invited them to submit briefs regarding the board's order, at that point, they could have raised issues regarding the fact that Judge Edelman's demeanor-based credibility determinations didn't hold water. They
could have raised that with the second ALJ.
Correct. And they could
have. There's no way they could go back to the board until after the second ALJ's decision. Isn't
correct.
That correct?
I think that is correct.
I can't find any other.
There's no opportunity to seek a reconsideration.
I don't think when they've remanded and it's not a final order. I know that if it's, for example.
They can't, when you say not final order, that means you can't ask us. But
right, but.
Also mean you can't ask
you, now, when it's a final order with the board, I know that you can ask for reconsideration prior to coming up on appeal for certain. For example, if the board had issued an order with a remedy that you disagreed with, you must first object to the remedy before the board, before you come up to the court.
But not after this first order, then. They could not have said, well, you've asked for. You ordered a non-de novo hearing, and the APA requires a de novo hearing.
Not that I'm aware of.
Would they have made that argument in their brief challenging Edelman's decision that you need to have a de novo hearing, and need to have a new hearing, and the APA requires it to be de novo?
Of course, that would have been appreciated, but they did not.
Haven't you just given away your 554D argument? You just told me the initial decision or the recommended decision was the one by Judge Davis. But he wasn't the one that presided at the reception of evidence. So
that was also in the back of my mind, and I would like to explain that. I think Judge Davis's decision incorporates or relies upon Judge Edelman's demeanor-based credibility determinations, and it did so per the board's instructions. So demeanor-based credibility.
Did he receive evidence? Did Judge Davis receive evidence, or did he preside at a hearing where there was the reception of evidence?
No, he did not.
Could he have under the board's order remanding?
If upon looking at Judge Davis's, or scratch that, Judge Edelman's decision, had he decided that those demeanor-based credibility determinations didn't hold water, he himself could have recalled witnesses and heard the oral testimony. And of course, the company or the bakery, prior to Judge Davis issuing his second decision, could have filed a brief requesting the ALJ Davis to do so. He could have pinpointed specific areas where Judge Edelman's alleged bias or alleged prejudice infected his decision, and that they didn't do that. The bakery didn't do that. They certainly had the opportunity.
Your argument is that it's not fatal to the hearing to have the initial decision rendered by someone who doesn't preside at the reception of evidence. So you're going to get away from text and go to purpose.
When that's all you have. Section 554D is the purpose is to prevent demeanor evidence from getting lost, and it didn't get lost here. Judge Edelman saw the witness's demeanor. He saw how they acted, and his demeanor findings were given a review by Judge Davis and by the board and found to comport with the evidence. The demeanor-based credibility findings are very much a part of the board's decision and of ALJ Davis's decision.
Could Davis have had a hearing on any issue that the company thought demeanor was relevant to? And as to which the written transcript wasn't good enough?
I will say this, that the bakery was given the opportunity to present that argument to ALJ Davis. What ALJ Davis would have done with that argument, I cannot say.
Well, I'm asking whether he had the authority to do something with
it. Yes, he did.
Because we have the text, but we also have our own decision on this section of the APA, which is the Miller decision by Judge McGowan. And in that case, he adopts the view of another Davis, that is Professor Davis, who wrote the Administrative Law Treatise, in which they both seem to take the position that not every case where you lose the first ALJ Do you have to have another one? It depends on how important demeanor is to the hearing. And that if demeanor is not important, or if the board could show that it would have reached the same, you know, on any hypothetical description of another witness, then the APA is inviolate. Now, I don't know where that comes from the language, but we do have our own decision on this, and we also have Davis, who's explaining what Congress meant when passed the APA. The problem is that there's so few cases in this area, it's a little hard to know, you know, whether this APA rule is one that literally means every time or only sometimes.
Of course, and I'd like to say that the board would have liked to have had the opportunity to look at those cases and issue a reasoned decision, but the issue was never raised to them. There isn't a distinct analysis. Just like you said, this court in Miller versus FCC, site 707 Fed 2nd 1530, addressed these very issues you're talking about. There is no written exception to 554D, but of course, if demeanor-based credibility determinations do not play an important role, then it's okay to switch batters, so to speak, switch hitters. You know, you can have an ALJ make a decision based on a cold record. That's a specific analysis that the board wasn't even given the opportunity to go through because the APA was never raised to them.
The APA wasn't. Okay.
The APA, the letters APA didn't appear, but the general objection was made and an APA cases were cited.
Right. And
so if one looked at the cases, wouldn't it be apparent that that was an APA complaint?
Your Honor, you use wonderful language there because you're right, the general objection was made.
Well, the general objection could be framed and was framed in due process terms.
Correct, it was.
It could also be framed in APA terms, and the cases do just that.
Well, he cites three cases, and as you pointed out, that the one case, Gamble-Sacomo, rests on two grounds, both the APA and the due process. The third case they cite, the Second Circuit case, never uses the word APA. It just cites, to Gamble-Sacomo as support. And I would say that the board should just not have to play the role of a scavenger hunt trying to figure out what theory is the bakery pursuing.
Is it a scavenger hunt when the exception says exception is taken to the board's direction that the ALJ may rely on Judge Edelman's demeanor-based credibility determinations unless they're inconsistent with the weight of evidence? I'm sorry, that's not the one I wanted, the first one. Exception is taken to the ALJ's failure to observe the witness's demeanor and to make independent credibility resolutions based upon his seeing and hearing the witnesses in his case.
What page is this?
That's A30.
That
APA is not in there, but I don't think we've ever required, we require notice and sort of specificity to the board. And what is unspecific about, how is the board not on notice there?
Your Honor, I would say first off that the bakery had no problem citing to the APA and using the words APA in every other page of its brief,
We don't require that, right? We don't require that sort of specificity.
But you do require.
Not this issue.
I think that this court actually had a wonderful quote regarding the specificity with which exceptions must be made. And they said, you can't expect an agency to provide a silk purse response to a sow's ear argument. And I think that the language used in both the exceptions and the brief could be construed as a credibility exception or as a due process exception. But I don't think the board would have been directed to go into the APA and look at Section 554D. I see that my time is about to run out, and if the court doesn't have any other questions, I ask that the court enforce the board's order and deny the bakery's petition for review.
Thank you, Ms. Hand.
Thank you.
Mr. Silverman, anything that you need to rebut rather than repeat?
Yes, sir.
Just one or two points. Number one, the discussion about whether or not demeanor was important in this case is hypothetical. In fact, the discussion about demeanor is directly relevant to this case because when you take a look at Judge Davis's decision and the board decision, you will see that those decisions are replete with references to Judge Edelman's credibility resolutions. I refer you to A48, footnote 4, where Davis said Edelman credited GC witness because he was more impressed with her demeanor. They appeared to be more forthright and less evasive. Based upon my favorable impression of their demeanor, they gave forthright and detailed accounts, again, A48 footnote 4. They even noted that credibility determinations may be made on nervousness and evasiveness of witnesses, and so it goes. Demeanor, credibility,
your argument is that those credibility determinations were inconsistent with the weight of the evidence, right?
No.
You didn't make that argument with respect to Edelman when you challenged
We raised the objection with respect to those credibility resolutions. That's right.
And you made just that argument when you were challenging Edelman's decision, you challenged them as inconsistent with the weight of the evidence.
Absolutely.
Well, and the board says that where they are inconsistent with the weight of the evidence, the new ALJ can start over again. That's what the remand said.
Well, the remand said that he can rely on the demeanor resolutions
unless they're inconsistent.
That's right. Correct.
So if he agreed with you, if you had raised this issue and he agreed with you, any of those demeanor issues could have been resolved by putting the witnesses back on.
No, not at all.
Why?
Because we would have had to call 20 witnesses to give their entire testimony. We didn't do that because we were satisfied with the testimony that our witnesses gave. We saw no need for it. There were obviously credibility issues here, questions of fact as to who to believe. We were content.
You do feel the need because I assume if you win here, you're going to put those witnesses on. There's going to be a new hearing, and you're going to put those witnesses
on. That's right, before a new judge.
Yes, but Davis was a new judge. The question is why not put them on before Davis?
Because Davis was limited and circumscribed in what he could do. He could only take further testimony, additional testimony. But if he went beyond the board's instructions, he would have been reversed because there are a whole line of cases. It wasn't briefed, Your Honor, but there's a whole line of cases that talks about where an ALJ goes beyond a specific grant.
I agree with that. That's obviously right. But the board said that he could do it if they're inconsistent with the weight of the evidence. If Edelman's decisions, based on demeanor, were inconsistent with the weight of the evidence, he could have.
Yeah, yes, and obviously he found that they were not inconsistent with the weight of the evidence.
He
didn't see the witnesses. He didn't.
So did you argue in front? Well, first of all, were you in front of the second ALJ at all?
No.
Or was this done on paper?
No. No.
But he offered you the opportunity to. It says no party requested that I open the hearing or recall any witness. I offered the parties an opportunity. None did.
That's correct.
So you did have, he made the offer.
He made the offer.
Did you instead argue that the determinations were against the weight of the evidence?
To Judge Davis?
Yeah.
No, we did to the board. But before Judge Davis, there was no argument. And from our perspective, there was no point in calling a witness for additional or further testimony.
Why wasn't there an argument? You were invited to make an argument. Why didn't you?
The reason why we didn't was because we view the only way to right the wrong was to have a new ALJ see the witnesses, test their demeanor, et cetera, with respect to all the issues, additional.
You had a new ALJ. Why didn't you say what you just said to us? You had a second ALJ.
Because it would have meant having to call the witnesses and have them give the same testimony that they gave before the first ALJ, and that was prescribed by the board. That's the de novo concept that the board rejected and said, no, you can't do that. And if Judge Davis did that, he would have been reversed because it would have gone beyond the grant given to him by the board. We have to parse the language.
I understand that they were saying not hold a de novo hearing altogether, but
yes.
They said that the new judge may rely on Judge Edelman's demeanor-based credibility determinations unless they are inconsistent with the weight of the evidence. So if you were to challenge, I don't know, 25, and there were only 25 demeanor determinations, and persuade them that they were inconsistent with the weight of the evidence, by the words of this remand order, he could have put on new testimony.
Well, additional testimony or further testimony, but not the same testimony that led to the issues in the case.
Well, I understand.
Whether
why
someone
not?
Was terminated, whether somebody walked away from an oven for 15 minutes or 10 minutes, whether somebody said X, Y, or Z. We would have had to put the witness on and say, For example, if they claim that we somehow threatened people because there was union organizing, that witness would have had to gone on and said the same exact thing, which is what they would have said because I was content with their testimony before the first trial judge. They would have had to get on the stand and say, no, I deny that I ever said that.
Well, they're going to have to do that now anyway, right?
If you prevail.
If you prevail, they're going to have to do it anyway.
That's correct. So because the second administrative law judge could have seen the case different. We don't know what Davis would have done if he saw the witnesses in front of him. He could have taken the witness's testimony and come to a completely different conclusion. But he relied on the conclusions that Judge Edelman reached with respect to demeanor, which were embedded in the briefs that he copied. And that's where the whole chain breaks down.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Silverman. Ms. Haney, thank you. The case is submitted.